Thank you.
Thank you. Our next case is Kyocera versus, I see all the nods I think I need to see.
They have a Qualcomm, yes, Your Honor.
Yes, okay. Mr. Phillips?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Ordinarily, I would start with the claim construction question, but there was a fair amount of focus on the DSU case in the previous argument, and that argument applies with, candidly, even greater force in this particular case, because in order to establish induced infringement in our case, there clearly has to have been a finding of specific intent, and the administrative law judge clearly rejected the idea that specific intent was required. Indeed, the last line on A449 is that intends to induce infringement because Qualcomm provides its customers with the system determination code. That may be sufficient for general intent, but that doesn't remotely satisfy the standards of DSU. And it's not the role
of
the
they're
court.
Providing instructions, training, updates, marketing, customer support. Why isn't that enough?
Well, there are two answers to that. First of all, that's not the finding that was made by the Commission, and under Chenery, this Court's not in a position to affirm the specific intent determination on a ground different from the one that the Commission itself has adopted. So, at a minimum, you have to vacate in light of DSU and send it back. And then, of course, the Commission would be free to consider that evidence. If you ask me as a matter of law whether I think the Commission can get there, I'd say the answer is no, because I think there's plenty of evidence that we acted with largely with indifference as to whether this particular mode was used, because we left it to all of our customers to modify the source code to provide any kind of battery saving they chose to provide. To be sure, we touted the fact that there was going to be available the options to try to save power. That was clearly a fact, and we would be foolish not to promote it on that basis. But the bottom line here is that as the case comes to the Commission solely on the basis of induced infringement, and the Commission has made a finding that's based solely on general intent and no effort to comply with this Court's decision in DSU, at a very minimum, the Court has to vacate and send it back. Now, I realize there are significantly broader issues that are implicated in this particular case. And candidly, the Court may not ever need to get to them if it simply follows what, to my mind, is the easiest course, which is simply to recognize specific intent wasn't a finding, and therefore the Court ought to send it back. An alternative ground for vacating and remanding is on the question of claim construction. And here, the claim is pretty straightforward. It is extremely broad. It's a second wireless communication different from the first wireless communication. And our understanding of that claim is pretty straightforward. We say a communication means a communication, and character and difference, any difference, is sufficient to satisfy that language. Now, Broadcom made an argument that, no, really, if you read it in the context of this particular patent application, what you see is that you're talking about interface protocols, sort of fundamentally different systems of providing it. The Commission rejected that, and Broadcom hasn't re-raised that issue as it comes here. Instead, the Commission adopted what it called methods of communication. Now, the term method of communication is not language that appears anywhere, certainly not in the claim, doesn't appear anywhere in the specification. So we are left to try to figure out where do you incorporate or import into the claim this particular limitation.
Are you saying that the claim, when it says first wireless communication, second wireless communication, that just simply means two messages?
Capable of two communications. I think what, the easier
what,
way...
Of what patentable consequence could that possibly be to warrant putting that in a claim?
Well, it would seem to me that at least one of the possibilities would be voice communication and data communication are two different communications. And therefore, you could well want to make sure that you cover both of them. But the key to this, I think, Judge Lynn, is not, does every word of the claim have to have some great inventive genius to it, but rather a party who is trying to figure out what does this claim relate to and what is it looking at, reading this would say, well, this doesn't relate to methods of communication. This just relates to different communications.
Well, the
Commission... And therefore, if you go to the prior art and you look at Sato and Boris and Moore, each of which specifically references both voice and data communication and dual modes, your natural inclination would be to say, well, they speak directly to this. And that's why
the Commission
this is
looked
an invalid
very clearly at the specification. and found in column 4 particularly and a little bit in column 5 several references that supported their different methods of communication. Can you address some of those?
Yeah, I mean the problem with
lines 24, 29, 56, 61,
right,
so on and so forth.
First of all, none of those are limitations. They are all written in broad language. They are all including or may include, etc. There's nothing in there that reflects.
But they're referencing different methods of communication there,
right.
LAN, wireless LAN, etc., infrared.
Right, but they don't purport to be defining the term a communication, which is the claim language that we're talking about.
No, but we read the claim in light of the entire disclosure. Here they're telling us the different types of communication.
But Judge Rader, you have to recognize that when you're reading this in terms of the entire disclosure, that a significant portion of the disclosure in this particular patent was restricted. Remember, there were two inventions embodied in this application, one of which they abandoned. And the one they abandoned was the different methods of communication, the different devices, the different transceivers that could go from one to another. So the fact that you have some of that language in here shouldn't come as a huge surprise, especially when you're talking about the background for the invention, because that part of the invention speaks directly to those methods of communication. The problem is when you get to the specific claim here for the battery-saving feature, for this notion of control frequency of scanning for access, when you get to that point, it's just a communication different from.
So that's two different emails or two different phone calls? I mean, we can take your difference argument to the other extreme as well. You have to put some context on the word different, don't you?
Well, sure, it has
and
to be.
So they found,
it clearly has to be different.
They found context. You wouldn't argue that it's just two different emails, right?
No, I think the easiest way to think about this is voice versus data as the two differences in the
and what supports that in the specification?
Well, if you look at 40, both on 11, figure 11, and on figure 47, when you're talking specifically, there's nothing that remotely restricts the nature of the communications to different methods of communication, and indeed, at least for my money, the hardest part for them to try to explain away is in column 39 on 37 or 8 on down, because the first part talks about access point provides for communication via one type. Okay,
what?
This is 39, column 39,
line 32,
right? It says the access point 1409 provides for communication via one type of radio communication, while access point provides for another. Okay, there you're talking about types, methods of communication. Read the next paragraph. In addition, access points might also exist in a single network for providing multiple communication paths in case one access point fails or becomes overloaded, suggesting, at least as I read that, clearly that they don't envision different methods of communication. They simply mean a communication different from another communication. And while that language is, to be sure, capacious, there is no reason in the world to impose any specific limitations that do violence to the specification as set out, at least in my mind, as plainly as it can be. And
well,
that's
there is more context to this, though, in the claim, is there not? Because it says, communication circuitry comprising a reduced power mode and being adapted to use these communications to transmit data to access points. So the two different communications that are referenced are different ways to used to transmit data. And normally when you're talking about different ways to transmit data, you're talking about different methods, different systems, different structures or something. So if you read this entirely in context, it does look like the reference to first communication and second communication is to different types of methods.
I think the answer to that is twofold. First of all, it's not consistent with the way the specification plays out, because they're not talking about methods. If you look at column 39 in the language I read, that's clearly not talking about different methods. It's talking about essentially the same method of communication. And second of all, however you want to describe the concept of voice and data mechanisms of communication, it seems to me quite clear that the prior art was very specific in recognizing that that exists, and that anyone reading a communication different from a second communication different from a first communication would say that what we're talking, at a minimum, you're talking about the difference between voice data, voice communication and data communication, and that is clearly embodied in the prior art, and which to my mind, undoubtedly anticipates what we have here in this particular claim. Putting over and above that, and I just want to take a second on that because the other part of the anticipation argument is the GSM. And there, I don't think there's any question that under anybody's interpretation, if there's different methods, there are clearly different methods of communication that are embodied in the GSM standards, because they're talking about two different fundamental frequencies, one that operates primarily in the United States, another one that operates primarily in Europe. So they're talking fundamentally different methods of communication. And the only argument really that was made by the Commission in that context is that these worldwide standards that are designed to, in fact, provide the basis upon which every mobile communication is going to be functioning was somehow concealed from the public. One, that's an utterly counterintuitive notion, but second, the evidence is quite clear that this was freely available, it was widely disseminated, and precisely for this purpose. And therefore, if you regard the GSM standards as prior art, which you should, they unquestionably anticipate.
But is the GSM standard or standards, is that a single reference is the problem? I mean, it seems to me, from my understanding of the way they work, you can correct me if this is not really a fair characterization, but it's more like saying, well, the Wikipedia is a single reference, even though it has thousands of articles written by different people, and if you combined something from one Wikipedia article and something from an entirely different one, you wouldn't be anticipating.
But Ms. Patet specifically testified about this and talked about how everything is integrated in and referenced back through in order to make it a single document that would be readily understandable and to provide it. I mean, the difference is Wikipedia is going to give you the answer to everything in the whole world. What this is designed to do is to give you the answer on how to run a mobile telephone
system. But it's altering.
And it does so very specifically, and deals with this precise
problem.
But
it's not a single, I mean, when we talk about the GSM standards, it sounds like we're talking about Chilton's auto repair for a 1989 Volvo. I mean, it's much more complicated than that, I take it. It's multi-volume,
sure.
Why would you give
the benefit to the patent holder, mm-hmm, against the claim of anticipation to say we're going to completely ignore that, when in reality what the GSM standard is designed to do is to say to the world, this is the way to handle all of the various aspects of this particular cell technology, including specifically the one that's at issue in this particular case, and that it does so well in advance of the patent that's being applied for here. And therefore, if you simply turn to it, you would know that that's already been anticipated. It seems to me the answer, the better way to pursue it, is to recognize that this is a source of extraordinary knowledge and use it as a hedge against expansive patent rights, rather than to ignore those kinds of claims that are out there.
Could a single person of skill in the art be expected to understand the entire GSM standard?
You could vacate and remand to the Commission, I suppose, to specifically decide that particular issue, because, again, remember, the Commission rejected this on the basis of the
experts in every little area of the standard, don't you?
Well, actually, I think Ms. Patet testified, and to be sure, I don't know whether she's the standard. She is probably the world's premier expert on it. I mean, she wrote an entire book evaluating all important aspects of it. And so, therefore, I would say that a person under those circumstances clearly could. But I guess
that's a person of ordinary skill. You've kind of taken her out of the game.
And I preface my comment, Judge Rader, with recognizing that she is an extraordinary expert. But I don't know that there was any specific testimony on that, because, again, I don't think you should. I don't see any reason why you would adopt an arbitrary restriction on the sources of information that anticipate patents. So, in the first place, I would reject the way the Commission analyzed that particular problem. And then, if you want to vacate and remand to the Commission to take up some of the other issues, that's fine. But I think that the bottom line here is that if this claim is properly construed, no matter how this claim is construed, if it's properly construed, under my view, The other three patents, clearly.
You say that the GSM standards anticipate even under the narrow
right,
construction.
Right, exactly. And that, to me, is the reason why the court ought to vacate and remand. Let me just take two more points. One is the obviousness.
By the way, Madame Pautet said she hadn't read the whole thing herself, right?
Right. She did write the comprehensive book on it, and I suppose I trust her to describe the important elements, at least, if nothing else. With respect to obviousness, it seems to me clearly that once you have all of the anticipations properly analyzed,
is that before us?
I'm sorry?
Is that before us?
I believe it is before you for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that the KSR standard was announced subsequent to the decision by the ALJ. But second of all, we plainly put obviousness before the ALJ with respect to the dependent claims, and the dependent claims always incorporate the independent claims. So I think that the court clearly could take that into account. And again, it seems to me we're talking about potentially crippling the entire wireless mobile industry. And at a minimum, the court ought to be confident that the nature of the patent claims here are not obvious before it goes down that path.
Go ahead. You had another point, and then I'll get to
that. I was going to shift on to Section 337.
Well, that's what I was going to ask about.
Okay.
All right. Whether Section 337 gives the right to a cease and desist order with respect to the induced infringement issue.
I mean, there's no question that it would that in the right kind of a case, I think there is general cease and desist authority. I think the problem
with
here
respect to induced infringement is that, in other words, if you just read the language of the first section of subsection of 337, you could come to the conclusion that this is really only talking about direct infringement. But you're conceding that it applies to induced infringement as well, and therefore, in the right induced infringement case, you could have a cease and desist.
I could imagine a cease and desist order. I mean, I do think the cease and desist order here has to go by the wayside for it because of the nature of the rest of the way the remedial scheme operates, because I think all the rest of it is clearly beyond the power of the commission to implement.
Commission saying...
Now you're talking about the other...
Right.
I'm really focusing just on the cease and desist order with respect
to... I understand that. But the cease and desist order is also tied to the way the manufacturers are doing what they're doing, and obviously if that part of the order goes away, I think it's clear that the cease and desist order would have to be vacated as well, apart from. I mean, I think there are obviously liability grounds for setting aside the cease and desist order.
I'm not sure I follow why that's true.
Because a lot of them have to do with what kinds of benefits you might be providing to the downstream manufacturers, et cetera, or what kinds of information you may be having, you may be providing them. And if they have no limitations on what they're allowed to do, at minimum, you would ask the commission to say, would you impose the same cease and desist requirements in light of the fact that you've changed anything else?
That's all I'm suggesting
there.
Mr. Phillips, should we hear from some of your...
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, in light of the colloquy on patent law issues and moving into 337, we stand here on behalf of 19 non-respondents. Most are manufacturers, some are service providers. Variety of companies and entities, but we have several things in common. One, we were not respondents. We were not named in the complaint. Broadcom had control over its complaint. Secondly, and relatedly, we were not found to violate the statute. That is, we think, fundamental. It is a fundamental flaw.
But they're going to say they're just infringing, they're just barring the in-rem product. They're only acting against the import.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. If I may say, the order sweeps against us, not just about Qualcomm chips. And I should also say, one thing that I think is undisputed is that the, quote, infringement itself is not the chips or chipsets, it's when, in fact, there is the use of the software, the enabling software. And our final point in which we share a very strong perspective is that this record is barren with respect to substantial evidence of infringement. They chose their case, they put on their case, It was an extraordinarily weak case. It doesn't come close to substantial evidence. I hope to spend my time, depending upon the court's questions, on the statute. Then my colleague, Ms. Frost, is going to speak with respect to the arbitrary and capricious nature of the order and the lack of substantial evidence as to certain entities. And then my colleague, Mr. Castanis, will talk about procedural issues, which I will talk to and speak to, depending on the court's questions, in terms of procedural flaws. He will speak to the due process implications that would flow if the court does not accept our interpretation of the statute. So let me turn to the statute itself, D1 and D2. We think D1 is pellucidly clear. It requires for a limited exclusion order for there, in fact, to be a determination with respect not simply to articles, but a person violating the provision. We were not found to violate. The commission said this in several places. I would like to quote from page A83, a very short quote, but it makes what we think is the fundamental case-ending point as to us. We should be out and relieved of this litigation nightmare. Here's what the commission said. We begin with the threshold question of whether the commission has authority to issue downstream relief where, as here, the downstream products are manufactured by parties not having been found in violation of Section 337.
What page was that again? I'm sorry.
That is at page A83. There are other such pages. Right. Your Honor, some few months before the commission made this statement, this court...
Looking at the statute that you're talking to us about, it doesn't talk about persons, it talks about entries and imports, things, not persons.
Your Honor, if I may, if one reads the entirety of D1, D1 goes on to say, imported by any person violating the provision of this section. And that combines with D2. If there was any lack of clarity prior to 1994 in terms of the reach of the Commission's power, Congress has now spoken in Chevron Step 1 language precisely and specifically to the question at hand. Because of the very kind of authority exercised here, sweeping in an entire industry, the GATT panel determined in the late 1980s that this was in violation of our solemn obligations under the General Agreement. Congress specifically focused on that, and you have in the briefs very clear articulations by, in both the Senate report and in the House report, explaining the language of D2. That is, if there is any doubt under D1, and there shouldn't be, in light of person violating the section, then D2 fills in any gap. There is none in D1, but if one says, well, what's Congress driving at? And Congress, of course, and the statute, of course, governs both, and this is elementary Chevron, the commission. And the commission has, frankly, not dealt with this in a very, what shall I say, articulable manner. When one reads its analysis of its authority, it sweeps past the very fact that because of the GATT violations, Congress said a limited exclusion order, and that's what was entered here, that's what was sought by Broadcom, the master of its complaint. Congress said that shall be limited to persons determined by the commission to be violating this section.
Mm-hmm. Well, why isn't it fair to read that section to mean, because I agree with Judge Schrader, the focus is on the articles throughout. These are in rem type remedies we're talking about. Why is it not fair to read that to talk about exclusion from entry of articles limited to the articles of persons determined by the commission, which is what we have here, articles that are manufactured by Qualcomm?
Your Honor, first, I would guide the court to focus on the GATT analysis and why that kind of analysis, which is in fact the pre-GATT amendments, the Uruguay Round Amendments in 1994. That was exactly what the Commission's policy was. But Congress said, no, you can't do that because that is raising questions. Why is that? Because of national origin treatment, a district court could not do that. And that's what GATT said and Congress agreed. A district court in an injunction could not do that domestically, and so the national treatment provisions requires this. But let me move to a procedural point, because I think our procedural point also answers the question. We have been determined, even though there was no violation, again, proven, there's a total lack of substantial evidence, we were denied rights under 337C. 337C says notice, opportunity to be heard. The opportunity, quoting from the language of the statute, each determination shall be made on the record after notice and opportunity for a hearing. We were excluded from this. We weren't named to begin with. And then the efforts at intervention at the liability phase, there was one effort, Verizon, told no. That's what litigation...
Well, I take it... Let me go back to the question, which I had exactly the same question as Judge Lynn. The construction of D2, I suppose you could read the persons determined by the Commission to mean articles of persons, even though you have to read those words. But doesn't that still have a problem when you read the rest of the clause, which says determined by the Commission, persons determined by the Commission to be violated? Your point is you aren't a person who's been determined to violate, so even if articles of are read in,
right,
that still doesn't get them where they need to go.
They are nowhere near, because articles are chipsets. We, of course, are manufacturers of handsets.
Yeah.
And again, the only evidence, the substantial evidence, is utterly lacking here because of the one handset, a single Samsung handset for the European market with a completely different regime. That simply doesn't work. But if I can make... I see my time has expired.
May I make one point about
D2? Picking up on Judge Bryson's question, what D2 goes on, without using the term general exclusion order, is to then set forth
exception.
If you want Broadcom to go after this entire community of folks around the world, an entire industry, then prove to the Commission that you need a general exclusion order. We think the language of the statute and the structure is absolutely clear, and it all begins with the complaint. Why didn't they name us? If those are the articles of abuse, this is basic fairness. We should have had the opportunity to be heard. They control the complaint. The comments of the court with respect to confidentiality suggest we don't know what the allegations are, and different appellants here had different bodies of information at different times. The point is, there is a veil of ignorance. There was no opportunity for us to be put on notice with respect to this, but this provision of C, we think, is absolutely clear and goes back to the very beginning, namely a complaint.
Now, you raised the general exclusion order issue, and I think you're quite right that 2 appears to be the way you can get to a general exclusion order through the exceptions to the general, more restrictive language of D2. But if I understand, prior to 1994, all there was one. I guess it wasn't denominated one. And yet, the Commission was issuing general exclusion orders at that time on occasion, I take it. So my question is, if the Commission could take one, including its language about imported by any person violating the provision of this section, and justify a general exclusion order prior to 1994, doesn't that suggest a broad reading for that language of at least D1? Setting aside now...
I don't think that follows, Your Honor.
Okay.
I don't think that the D2 power with respect to general exclusion, which Congress has essentially, we're going to permit that to go, even though it's controversial in the international trade community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what Congress was trying to say here is very simple. If you want to exclude articles of Motorola, Samsung, you name them in the complaint. You know who they are, you name them in the complaint. You don't seek, which is exactly what happened here, the functional equivalent of a general exclusion order, but to simply proceed under a limited exclusion order with the various rights that we have, but were denied.
Why is a general limited exclusion not a horizontal distinction, meaning we're talking about parties similarly situated to Qualcomm, not the downstream users?
I think the general exclusion order, in fact, has been interpreted as being too downstream in order to vindicate the policies of the statute. So we do not quarrel with the possibility that there is power on the part of the Commission to issue a general exclusion order with respect to downstream if the provisions of D2A and B are met. There's no suggestion that those provisions have been satisfied here. I thank the Court.
Thank you. Ms. Frost?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I will address why the remedy order must be vacated as arbitrary and capricious and not supported by substantial evidence, irrespective of how the Court decides the other issues presented here today. There are three fatal flaws in the order that require vacation of that order, which I'll briefly discuss. The first is the Commission's decision to, out of the blue and without warning, exclude QWERTY devices such as RIM BlackBerries and Palm Trios and Centro smartphones from importation. The second is the Commission's decision to exclude WCDMA devices without a clear or sufficient evidentiary basis for doing so. The third is the Commission's decision to impose a downstream remedy at all without a sufficient evidentiary record.
Aren't these all Qualcomm chips?
Yes, Your Honor. There are Qualcomm chips in the products, but that's not what's being excluded, just the chips. It's the actual handsets. With respect to QWERTY, to start with, the exclusion of QWERTY devices was contrary to the patent owner Broadcom's specific request. During the proceedings before the ALJ, Broadcom affirmatively declined on the record, or declared on the record, that it was not seeking relief against PDAs, smartphones, or data cards. The ALJ acknowledged and accepted this. The staff agreed with Broadcom and advised the Commission that QWERTY devices should be exempted from the exclusion order. Nonetheless, in contravention of the patent owner's election not to pursue a remedy against QWERTY devices, and against the Commission's longstanding policy to grant relief no broader than requested by the complainant, the Commission arbitrarily and without warning excluded QWERTY devices from importation in its limited exclusion order. The Commission abused its discretion again in excluding WCDMA-capable devices. Qualcomm chips for operation and handsets for use on WCDMA networks like AT&T Mobility's HSDPA WCDMA network, or T-Mobile's then proposed one, were not the focus of the investigation. They were not specifically accused of infringement in the complaint. No party sought discovery from either AT&T Mobility or T-Mobile. Discovery was specifically limited to CDMA, GSM, and EVDO platforms, which were the main focus of the case. The evidence in the record regarding WCDMA was scant at best and insufficient, as the dissent clearly pointed out. Nonetheless, the Commission majority entered an exclusion order barring WCDMA-capable handsets. Finally, the Commission abused its discretion by excluding downstream products at all. The Commission considered a total exclusion of all products containing Qualcomm chips and rejected it as too harmful to third parties, especially wireless networks, and as contrary to the public interest. Broadcom's suggested remedy fared no better and was likewise rejected as harmful to third parties and contrary to the public interest. The Commission went to great lengths here to try to to get a record
any
together.
Any final comments, Ms. Frost?
Yes, Your Honor. The commission's order is an abuse of discretion, represents abuse of, an abuse of discretion, because it must be vacated because there was no evidence upon which it could base a limited, the limited exclusion order that it entered.
Thank you very much. Mr. Castanias?
Castanias, Your Honor.
Castanias.
Thank you very much. That's all right. I've heard it before. And may it please the court. In the brief time I've got this morning, I want to talk a little bit about the due process problems that would be created if you don't adopt the interpretation of the statute.
The ITC made a special point out of convening a hearing on remedies and opening it up and giving everyone notice. Doesn't that meet due process?
Not. It's way too late, Your Honor, because at that point, liability has already been established. And what we're talking about here principally is our ability to defend against a finding of liability. Now, to frame the due process argument, Your Honor, I think it's worth stepping back for a second from doctrine and taking a look at this question. How did it come to pass here? How did it come to pass that the ITC issued an order excluding at least 16 different manufacturers' wireless devices without either those companies or their devices actually being before the ITC? How did it happen that they weren't allowed to present defenses of non-infringement? How did it happen that they weren't allowed to present defenses of invalidity to amass their own set of prior art against these patents? How did this happen? The due process clause would never have allowed that to happen in a district court. Blonder tongue would have forbidden the sort of preclusive effect.
Didn't many of you get actual notice via subpoenas during the liability phase, which would have enabled you on the basis of that actual notice to seek to have your rights vindicated?
Judge Rader, that notice might have notified somebody that there was a proceeding pending, but it wasn't notice that these companies' products or their livelihoods
are
in
you,
these markets were
Are you
risk.
Trying to convince us you really didn't follow this at all?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, with respect to the members of this industry, there is no record, so I can't tell you what the record would reflect. That's one of the problems here. Another one of the problems about not following it is that we're talking about members of an industry that aren't located in the United States in many cases. And they certainly, under 44 U.S.C. 1508, are not presumed, even if Federal Register notice were enough, which it's not under Mullane, which I'll get to in a minute. But under 1508, Federal Register notice only is presumed to be sufficient for the United States of America.
Remind me, I know it was referenced in the brief, so I just can't remember. Were there efforts to intervene at the liability stage?
Verizon made an effort to intervene at the liability stage and was rejected.
Right.
At that point, the die was cast. It would have been fruitless for anybody else to try.
Now, let me ask you this question. Assume that this case had been begun as a general exclusion order case, you know, with that as in mind as the remedy sought, how would your situation be different with respect to the due process issues?
So if I understand the hypothetical, the case starts as a general exclusion
right.
order case,
right.
but results in a limited exclusion order.
Well, let's assume that it results in a general exclusion order, but you are equally out of the liability phase and the remedy phase,
mm-hmm.
For certainly the liability phase, right?
That's right. And
why wouldn't your due process argument have the same punch as it does with respect to the LEO?
Well, I think if you look at D2, Your Honor, a general exclusion order is only available in a limited set of circumstances. Under 2A,
but those circumstances have nothing to do with your particular...
But they might. They might. I would say, first of all, of course, that a general exclusion order would not be appropriate here because we were findable. You can go to the Qualcomm website and find the list of all of its licensees. It would not have been much more than basic due diligence to find that out. We know from Mullane that notice reasonably calculated to apprise potential respondents is what's necessary. The Federal Register notice isn't enough there. And with regard to the general exclusion order requirements in Section D2 of subsection D2 of section 337, those requirements roughly parallel the situations where, under Mullane, publication notice is enough. It's where it's difficult to identify all of the possible respondents or where it's otherwise necessary. If the best you can do is publication notice, then Mullane says that's okay with regard to due process. Let me just, on that due process note, let me just address a couple of other things. There is an undercurrent in the ITC and Broadcom briefs that we don't have any due process rights because we're talking about imports. And for that proposition, they cite the 1904 case in Butfield. This is a procedural due process case, not a substantive due process case. And it's very clear that even when administrative law is at issue and you're talking about adjudications,
they do make reference to that doctrine, but they put more weight, I think it's fair to say, on the in rem aspect, the in rem nature.
They do, and it's important there, I think, to note that in both Mullane and in the Supreme Court's later decision in the Mennonite Missions case in 1983, the court said very clearly that the same due process protections apply, whether it's in rem, quasi in rem, in persona. In fact, if anything, if you look at the in rem cases that the Supreme Court has had, whether they be in civil forfeitures or otherwise, there is a heightened risk of a deprivation of due process in those circumstances.
Some final thoughts, Mr. Castanis?
Yes, Judge Rader. Ultimately, the comment that's made in particular in the Broadcom briefs, they make very colorful use of the Bleak House analogy, and they say, oh my gosh, if we had had to name all of these people as respondents, well, there are 16 of us as manufacturers here. And right now, the same ALJ who had this case is handling a case where I represent the complainant with 49 different respondents, all named as respondents in that case. It was a two-day Markman hearing on four patents, very common for a district court action. And ultimately, what I want to leave the court with is this. If this case had happened in this way, in a federal district court, neither Blondertongue nor Supreme Court jurisprudence on virtual representation would have allowed this induced infringement finding, where Qualcomm was left to defend against the charge that there were direct infringements by handset manufacturers, that never would have been allowed to be preclusive in later litigation or in the same case against manufacturers like ours.
Thank you, Mr. Castanis.
If the district court would not have allowed that, it would have a national treatment problem for the same reasons that the GATT panel had. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Castanis. Before we move on, I calculate somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 minutes of overrun, so each of Ms. Kaysen and Mr. Van Ness will have four additional minutes should they need to use them. That'll keep time roughly even.
May it please the court. Mm-hmm. By any standards, the action taken by the commission in this case was reasonable and measured. This is particularly so when viewed in the context of the statutory purpose, to provide remedial relief against the importation of articles that infringe valid U.S. intellectual property rights.
You're going to have to help us read the statute. It talks about limited to persons determined by the commission to be violating.
Yes, this again comes into section 337D2, which was added to the statute in 1994 specifically and precisely to address the concerns addressed by a GATT panel report, in which the issues were whether entities, firms that were not named in an order that produced parallel, that is, horizontal products to those that were produced and found infringing, could be excluded, whether those products could be excluded. And the statute and legislative history clearly state that Section D2 was added only for that purpose. It was not added for any reason to address downstream products. In fact, nowhere in the legislative history or in the statute is the term downstream products precisely mentioned. This court has previously held in the Hyundai case, using the language that was then Section 337D and is now Section 337D1, that the commission does have authority, where appropriate, to issue orders extending to downstream products, provided it applies a proper test. And the commission in this instance, and in that instance in EPROMS, provide a 9-factor test where it looked at the factors specific to whether the downstream products were necessary as in this case, where virtually all of the infringing products come in as integral parts of a downstream product, is it then necessary to exclude those downstream products?
But Hyundai and the EPROMS tests don't really inform the statute as amended in 1994, and we're left with the language that Judge Rader pointed out that we've discussed previously. The D2 talks about excluding from entry articles limited to persons determined to be violating the section. Now, I asked Mr. Starr whether that section shouldn't properly be read as if it meant exclude articles limited to the articles of persons determined. And it seems to me that that's not entirely the right way to look at this statute, and that you have a problem in defending the application of this statute to downstream products in the circumstances of this case. Well, why am I wrong?
First of all, if you look at the title of Section 337D, it's exclusion of articles from entry. That's what this whole section is talking about. And it has always been interpreted that way, going back to the In Re Sealed Air case and the In Re Orient cases. Now, the Commission, we shouldn't confuse the fact that the Commission does conduct an in personam proceeding in the initial stages of the investigation under 337A. It looks specifically to see is there a violation based upon an infringement that is found. Having done that, the Commission then turns to 337D, where Congress has mandated that it issue an exclusion against the articles found to be infringing. At that point, once you get to remedy, you are now in an interim proceeding. And it is true the Commission has to have first found a violation, that some person is violating the statute. It then looks to how do we best exclude the articles that are infringing, the articles that are causing that violation.
Well, the violation here is only by Qualcomm, correct?
Correct.
All right. So Qualcomm is the person determined by the Commission to be violating this section, right?
Correct.
So the entry of articles shall be limited to persons determined by the Commission to be violating this section on its face would suggest that it's only Qualcomm's articles that can be excluded.
That's correct, and that's what a limited exclusion order, and that's what this case is again, it's about the source. What is the identity of the product, the upstream product? Well,
are you saying that's what's going on here? Is that
yes.
This is
yes.
All that's being excluded is Qualcomm's articles?
Yes, because there are two different concepts that the appellants seem to conflate. One is the decision between the identity of the product of the producer who's producing the infringing article, in this case Qualcomm, versus which, as opposed to other producers of chips who are not named. And there's a different concept as to the vertical concept, as to what do you do with those identified infringing products, here Qualcomm's infringing MSN chips, when those are incorporated into downstream products, and they enter the country almost virtually all the time in those downstream products.
Well, now,
how do you then exclude the infringing products?
And what do you say is to the language from D1, imported by, here again, any person violating the provision?
Right,
that these goods were imported by Qualcomm? Now, we're talking about when they come in the handsets, not at the earlier stage.
The Commission would interpret the violating in D1 is different from somebody determined to violate. Having issued the order, you are now violating. Any person is now violating the provision. Once the Commission has determined it's a violation, any person is now violating the provisions of the statute when it continues to import or sell for importation or sell after importation the products that have been found to infringe. The determination of violation has to be specific to a person. But once there has been a violation, any other person can violate the provision.
Even if they haven't been adjudicated to be a violator?
That's correct. And
So a person violating could be anyone, whether they had notice or not.
And anybody's importing the infringing articles. Because if you read it any other way, then you can just have new importers can come along and import the same exact product produced by the same person found to violate.
Well, then you don't need the by any person violating the provision of the section, do you? I mean, you just said if the articles, which have been adjudicated to be infringing, are imported by any person, you could leave out the violating the provision of the section, couldn't you?
Well, no, actually, that would emphasize that, for example, the patentee himself could import the product, or somebody licensed could import the product. That would not be a violation. it basically sends a message to Customs that there are some circumstances under which those products can come in, for instance, if they're licensed.
You relied on the Hyundai case, but in that case, there was one person, Hyundai, one named party, who was doing all of the importing. There were the downstream products were the products of Hyundai. This is very different, isn't it? Why not require naming the different downstream parties? Why not simply require them to be named up front and rely on this language from the statute as the reason for that?
The statute nowhere requires that a complainant name any particular parties. The statute, in this case, the inducement was by Qualcomm, and the complainant properly named Qualcomm. And I'd note, just by parallel, an inducement case, in any of the inducement cases you look at, you never see the plaintiff naming the inducee. It's almost always a name, just the inducer. So it's very strange that appellants would claim that it's different, because it really is not different in those circumstances. And it
but in those normal circumstances, the remedy is directed at the inducer.
The remedy is,
there's no need to name the inducee.
The same would be true here. You're basically affecting if you were to issue order just precluding the entry of the chips. That means somebody could take those chips and manufacture them U.S. manufacturer could not take those chips and manufacture them in a handset, but a foreign manufacturer would be allowed to bring them in freely. And that would be inequitable. It would basically be contrary to the purpose of the statute.
You said the remedy only went to the chips, a U.S. manufacturer could not make the chips.
Right.
Well, why not? Why the U.S. manufacturer could, assuming that there had been an adjudication in a case involving another defendant of patent infringement, that wouldn't bind the second potential defendant, if I understand your example.
I'm talking about a 337.
Let's assume it's a district court proceeding. In a district court proceeding, once there's an adjudication of infringement with respect to defendant X, defendant Y isn't bound by that. Defendant Y can have a whole new adjudication.
If defendant X can't sell the product and give the support that causes the infringement, then the inducee can't then infringe.
Oh, okay.
I think it's similar here. Also, I'd also note that the Hyundai case, one of the factors that the commission looked at and set out in that case is who is the downstream manufacturer of the product. And again, this test, although it is distinct from Hyundai in this factual circumstances, the test was cited approvingly by the Hyundai court as a proper balancing test for the analytical framework here. As what do you do? What are the factors unique to determining whether a downstream product should be excluded from entry? And I also just note also that, as we cited in our brief, several provisions of Section 337D2 talk about exclusion orders limited to products of named persons. Again, it's clear that subsection 337D2 is intended for the limited exclusion order to be limited by the source of the product, the parallel source, and not by the downstream producer. Turning to some of the due process claims that have been raised, we would suggest that the Mullane set of cases really are not probative here. Those cases, the appellants have cited dozens of cases in the Supreme Court dealing with the issue of seizure of property in the United States, a father's paternity rights, but those are entirely different issues from the issue of your right to import. And clearly, the Supreme Court held in 1904 and has not overruled that the right to import, an invitation to import, is not subject to constitutional due process rights. And this court in the R.J. versus Bush case, in fact, discussed the 200 years worth of case law explaining that. Now, of course, in the NEC case, the court discussed with maybe some concern some of these principles, but at the bottom line of the NEC case was where a party is named and charged and is a party to a proceeding. In those instances, yes, the party is entitled to certain procedural rights, fairness, and a non-prejudicial hearing. In this case, Qualcomm certainly was entitled to all of those. Qualcomm is named in the case, and under Section 337B was served with notice. And Qualcomm has not alleged and certainly was not treated in unfair, unjust, or unfair, biased manner. They received all their due process rights.
You're saying there's no procedural due process to an unnamed importer?
There is under the statute. The statute,
but you get nothing beyond what the statute
there is. That's correct. There is a statutory right. And the statute requires that the commission publish a Federal Register notice giving information about the investigation and its initiation. And the commission did just that here. And by the title, the investigation covered the Qualcomm chips as well as products containing those chips, including handsets. And further, as the court has noted, and we said in our brief at page 78, and the commission's opinion at page A94, several appellants had actual notice through a receipt of subpoenas or other confidential types of consultations with the counsel throughout the investigation.
Well, but actual notice in this context, if you don't have a right to participate, is just an opportunity to stand on the sidelines and cheer for the one team.
They had the right. They could have moved to intervene.
But I gather that was why I asked the question about that. And I gather that the one would-be intervener got told to pack his bags and stay away.
They moved. That was Verizon, who moved to intervene on the eve of trial. They waited until about a week before the trial. After this is almost 9 months or 10 months into the case, after this evidence is replete with evidence that they and other parties had actual notice well prior to that time.
Do you think they would have been entitled with a timely application as a matter of right to intervene?
I believe that would have been something for the judge to decide whether the criteria were met for intervention. And we would note the commission has a presumption that it will allow parties to intervene when they move in a timely fashion and meet the criteria for intervention. And in fact, some of the appellants did move to intervene for only remedy purposes and did participate, such to the extent that they're complaining that they did not have any say in what remedy the commission award, what remedy the commission issued. Of course, they did participate fully. And in fact, the commission took many of their comments and concerns into account in determining to narrow the order to the extent that it did. Now, some of the appellants complained that they were not apprised of the scope of the order the commission ultimately issued. Again, the title of the investigation made it clear that it applied to all handsets. Broadcom's complaint applied to all handsets containing the Qualcomm chips. The remedy notices specifically asked for comments on the appropriate remedy without any qualification. The public ID issued by the ALJ specifically referenced a phone that was said to be on sale in the United States for use in the singular, now AT&T, mobile network or T-Mobile. So clearly those parties had notice that their phones could be affected by the order. And the fact that they waited until 2 weeks before the commission finally issues determination and no other parties could have a chance to respond does not mean that they were entitled to anything else, any other fair notice of what the commission was going to do. I'm just briefly addressing some of the issues that Mr. Carter raised. Mr. Phillips, I'm sorry. First of all, we note that this is a classic case of inducement.
I'm sorry.
This is a classic case of inducement. It's very, no matter what standard you look at here, clearly the judge found the findings here clearly support a case where the parties were in a design partnership. Qualcomm provided instructions, advertising, support, continued encouragement to use these chips with the software combination. And it's very difficult to think of a case where you could have more facts pointing towards inducement by a producer, Qualcomm in this case, as it acted in concert to aid and abet the manufacturers in the use of infringing software.
Is it intent to cause the acts or intent to cause infringement? Because if it's infringement, that brings into question validity, and you can only infringe a valid patent. And then we have all sorts of issues as to whether or not there can be specific intent if there are questions about validity. Can you address that for me a little bit?
I believe that reasoning is rather circular, because it would mean that any time there's a patent out there and somebody is encouraging infringement of it, they can always claim as a defense in court or before the commission, oh, well, we don't think it's valid. So you really would never be able to have a finding of induced infringement, because that defense would always be available. So I think that the fact that a party can now come before you and say, well, it's not valid, is not a defense against induced infringement. The fact that they knew about the patent and knew that they were encouraging and abetting the manufacturers and using the software meets the standards under DSU and every standard the court has ever set forward on inducement.
Would it make a difference if they possessed an opinion of counsel with respect to validity?
That's not the case here, but I don't think it would, because it still would raise the same concerns. It still would raise the same issues that anybody can go get an opinion of counsel. They still know about the patent and they're inducing infringement. They can go for a declaratory judgment if they're concerned.
It'd be different if they had an opinion with respect to infringement as opposed to validity.
If they knew there was no direct, if there were a finding in another case there was no direct infringement, then you couldn't have induced infringement, because that's the first element of induced infringement, that there be actual direct infringement by somebody.
Your basic argument is that, well, it's almost impossible to prove an intent to induce infringement, because people could always raise the validity of defense. But aren't we in almost the same posture with willfulness? And in Seagate, we still raised the bar for willful infringement? Giving someone who has genuine validity concerns a rather easy way to avoid willfulness?
And willfulness, the bar, that's why you have a willfulness standard. The bar is raised in a willfulness finding.
I'm wondering if this is analogous, if the DSU change on intent caused an analogous raising of the bar.
I would say that it didn't, because it's a different standard that you're looking at. And you can have willful infringement by its nature is that goes a step higher than just a normal infringement or just wanting to induce somebody to infringe a patent that exists.
Well,
it's known that the patent is valid. And
there's still a good reason we make it hard to prove inducement. It is indirect, after all. So we do make it tough, and this intent is the critical aspect of that. Are we honoring enough the difficulty of proving indirect infringement in this case?
In this case, there is no finding of invalidity anywhere. Yes, in this case, it is so clear that Qualcomm is providing support, instruction, and is in that design partnership. They are intricately locked with the manufacturers in designing and using and continuing to use these chips in an infringing fashion, that it really would be difficult to think of another case where you could have a more strong example of inducement. This is the case.
Well, that all goes to the acts, and certainly the partnership relates to the activity. There's no question about that. But that still leaves unanswered this question about the requirement to show specific intent to infringe.
Here they specifically encouraged the manufacturers to use this handset even after the complaint was filed. They
encouraged
continued
all
to
of these acts. There's no question about that. So that's fine. But where does that show the specific intent to infringe? Now, maybe your argument is, well, they are aware of the patent. That in and of itself is enough.
I would say that that's what's been held in institute forum and in DSU cases. That's what is actual constructive knowledge of the patent is sufficient if you know about that and you're aiding and abetting the actions that constitute infringement. That's what induced infringement has been defined as.
But is it enough just to know of the patent? The patent sitting in the drawer of general counsel or something, or is there something more required in terms of either of prior notice of a charge of infringement or some analysis of a claim as to whether a claim reads on a device or something of that sort?
I don't think the cases would say that. I think the whole line of cases do not say that. In this case, again, we would note that even after the complaint was filed here, Qualcomm continued to induce infringement by these manufacturers. And in fact, much of the evidence that's adduced at the depositions in the hearing here talks about continued partnership between Qualcomm and the manufacturers, having been on notice about Broadcom's claims that these products are, in fact, infringing this patent. It's not a patent that's sitting in a drawer.
Thank you, Ms. Kaysen. Mr. Van Ness.
It please the court. I do want to begin where you are right now with the patent issues, and then I do want to address the statute and the remedy as well. But let's just start right where the court is. On inducement, the findings here on this patent were far more extensive than what we talked about a little bit earlier. First of all, there was a finding of direct infringement by Qualcomm's chips themselves. Judge Bullock found that the chips programmed to perform these functions directly infringed five separate claims of the 983. So there was a finding of direct infringement. And then at page 449 of the appendix, Judge Bullock found that not only is there a design partnership, not only is Qualcomm recommending that handset makers implement these features, not only are they knowingly inducing them to, quote, reduce the frequency of scanning for access points, which is precisely what the patent calls for, but, he found, they had knowledge of the infringing acts. I mean, what he found here was they encouraged them, they taught them, they directed them, they had knowledge of infringing acts, not just of conduct, but infringing acts, and, he found, that they intended to induce infringement. And he was cognizant of this sort of general and specific idea because he points out that this constitutes, this conduct, more than just general arguments. This constitutes a showing that Qualcomm had knowledge of the infringing acts.
But where he says that, it's true that you quoted him accurately so far as it goes, but he does say that Qualcomm intends to induce infringement because Qualcomm provides its customers with the system determination code. And that seems to me to qualify the, or at least explain what he means by intent in a way that might bring into question whether he's really applying the right standard.
Your Honor, I think that language really summarizes or is an attempt to sort of encapsulate the whole thing. He's
right.
Making a
whole
series
of findings. That's
right
at the very end of that discussion. That's true.
And I think that on these findings, which are findings of fact, it's a substantial evidence test, and he
outlines substantial evidence through a filter, and the question is, was he using the right filter?
I think he was. He said here that they had knowledge of the infringement and intended to induce it. Now, in the old days, before DSU, arguably, all you had to show was knowledge of an act that turns out later to infringe. Here, he's saying they've got knowledge of infringement and they are encouraging it through their work with their customers. And here, remember, also in the record, they don't have an alternative non-infringement position. I mean, their only argument is the one that Mr. Phillips advanced on the claim construction. On this claim construction, they conceded infringement. Their expert testified. He didn't even test the customer chips. Their expert did not even test the customer's chips. They conceded that if they couldn't change the claim construction, they had a clear situation of infringement, which is why the chips were found to infringe and they were found to infringe in the cell phones and on the networks.
But
so
what's the interplay between the claim construction argument and the intent? If they really believed, reading the Sorensen case, that difference meant any kind of difference, such as Mr. Phillips was suggesting to us, the simple difference between radio and voice communications. If they really believed that, did they have intent to infringe?
I don't think, point one, Your Honor, I don't think that anyone has ever, I don't think any case has addressed the notion of If your only basis is claim construction, that's enough. There's clearly no law on it. But I would say here, that claim construction that they're advancing now is far-fetched, and I want to turn to that next. But just to close the point on inducement, I want to make it clear there was a finding of direct infringement, and then working with these customers on a regular, repeated basis after knowledge of the claims of the patent and directing them and recommending to them that they implement these battery-saving features. Now, on the claim construction, I mean, it is, Judge Bullock went carefully through the specification, just as the court did in the Sorensen case, and he found in many, many places two things. First, he found lots of descriptions of the invention that indicated it was an invention that works with two different methods of communication. Judge Rader referred to column 4, and clearly there we're referring to different methods like wired LAN, LAN, wide area network. Column 5 is maybe even more clear. There, the invention itself is described as something having two transceivers with, quote, different operating characteristics for conducting data communications on different subnetworks. This is a description of the invention itself. And it goes on to say that these different subnetworks could include wired, wireless, radio frequency, wired network communications, and infrared.
Mr. Phillips sent us to a place in column 39, starting with line 31. How would you deal with that particular passage?
I mean, that plays right into what Judge Bullock found. As he pointed out, the paragraph immediately preceding that makes crystal clear that this device works when you have one type of radio communication and then another type of radio communication, and it gives some examples. It then goes on and says, in addition, you could also do other things. That doesn't mean that you're not working in a dual mode. It says you could also do some other things within the context of this. And I think possibly the clearest of example of what Judge Bullock found, and he cited this in the ID, is at column 42. Column 42, line 22, says, point blank, the present invention contemplates various combinations of communication technologies, all accommodated by communication modules. There is simply no question that what Judge Bullock did was exactly what this panel has admonished district judges and ITC to do, and that is read the claim in light of the specification. It is abundantly clear throughout that this invention is working on two different communications methodologies.
But the text that Mr. Phillips referenced that you just referred to in column 39, the in addition language,
yes,
is a reference to figure 47, and the in addition with reference to figure 47 talks about access points 1409 and 1413 might also exist on a single network. So it's not in addition to a system such as outlined in figure 47. This is in addition, meaning in the alternative.
I'm not sure it's that clear, Your Honor. I do know that figure 47, of course, makes abundantly clear that you're talking about two different communication methods. It's one of the things that Judge Bullock relied on in reaching that conclusion.
Absolutely. And, but then the question remains, what does this additional language mean?
It does.
At line 37 through 40.
But it has little to do with claim 1. I mean, what he was construing was different methods of communication in claim 1 and the other independent claims. And those claims are all directed towards these different methods of communication as fully really elucidated by this.